Well, there are corruption charges that could be brought against Prime Minister Netanyahu. He has called for new elections in Israel. We'll talk about that today. Plus, what do the Israelis think about President Trump's decision to pull our troops from Syria?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us, friends, on today's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Any Jewish-related question of any kind, phone lines are open. I've been seen this for a while, but just noticed it even more recently, the striking parallels between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump. Now, many of the things I'll say are known to you and obvious to you, but there's a crisis now in Israel, and Prime Minister Netanyahu has called for new elections. All right. So in Israel, you have elections at a certain period of time, just like in America. But let's say there's a government crisis. Let's say that your majority ruling party or ruling coalition, I should say, is being threatened. You can call for early elections, and that's what Prime Minister Netanyahu has done. So before I tell you about some of the parallels between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, let's just step back and look at what's happening in Israel now. So the Knesset, the parliament, that has 120 seats. And to have a ruling coalition, you have to have at least 61 seats. You say, well, yeah, but you just vote for whoever's prime minister. No, no, you vote for a party. Yes, the prime minister is the best known person in the party. So the party head becomes the prime minister. So in this case, Netanyahu, who, by the way, is, if reelected, would be serving his third full term and would have passed now any other previous prime minister as the longest leading prime minister, elected official in Israel. So it's significant. He's played a major role. You're talking just from 1948 to 2018. So he's played a major role. But what happens is this, you vote for parties, and there are numerous parties. It's not just two or three, there are 10, 12, 15, even more that ultimately put forth candidates and put forth platforms. So then the people vote for the different parties. So right now, if elections were held today, the indications are that the Likud party, the right-wing nationalist party known for strong security, known for Netanyahu's policies, they would get 30 votes, so 25%. They would get 30 seats out of 120. You say, that's tiny. That's nothing at all. No, no, that would be a very, very large percentage compared to everybody else. You know, the next competitive party, left-wing party, maybe they'll get like 12 seats or something like that. So that means that Netanyahu and Likud would then work with other parties that are similar in ideology and say, okay, let's join together and then we can have a government coalition. Well, here you have maybe an ultra-Orthodox Jewish party. Maybe they get 5 or 6 seats. So it's a small amount, but they're power brokers because they know that they may be needed in the government. And they say, okay, you're going to have to back off on this position if we're going to join the coalition. So you go back and forth and back and forth. Netanyahu is obviously a master at doing all this. And then you have your majority and then you set up your coalition. So because there's controversy over recent moves by the prime minister last month with a ceasefire with Gaza and not going in after Hamas, many were disappointed with that, upset over it. His majority now is razor thin. And there are corruption charges being brought against him. Three primary charges of fraud, of bribery, of pay for influence, For example, here's some companies donating large amounts of money to him, and then he works out some special arrangement with the government, allegedly, to benefit these companies, overseas companies, different things like that, or works with one newspaper versus another and is going to suppress information. So there are three separate charges coming against Prime Minister Netanyahu, and he has decided now with the coalition so razor thin that he is going to call for early elections. So there was a vote today on it because the Knesset has to agree to do it. And you want to talk about an overwhelming majority vote. It was stunningly strong to vote to dissolve the Knesset. Only a couple of those saying no. So Israel's Knesset officially dissolves, ushering April 9th elections. Headlines are proclaiming that. So what that means now is that the government is going to be, well, it's going to be day and night campaigning. So the Knesset is basically saying, okay, we're not doing anything now. For the next few months, we're not doing anything. We're not passing laws. They dissolved. Okay. This happens. And what is this? Roughly the 20th government since 1948. Then there'll be the elections on April 9th. And then the question is the attorney general, whatever the equivalent would be there, who is potentially bringing charges against prime minister. Will he bring the charges during the elections? Well, if he does, won't he be accused of trying to influence the elections? What if he waits until after the elections? Could the prime minister say the people have voted and they don't care about these charges? True or not, they don't care. They know I'm the man to lead this country, and my party is the party to lead the country. So that's another possibility. Now, it's possible the charges would be dropped, but it's also possible that he could be indicted. Ehud Olmert, former prime minister, was indicted and had to serve time. Others say, well, indict him. We don't care. We'd vote for him anyway. We'd stand with him anyway. So another volatile time in Israel, but right now, it seems that Netanyahu has a clear path for Likud to have victory again on the one hand. On the other hand, what if these corruption charges come against him? How would that affect things? 866-348-7884. Any Jewish-related question of any kind, Hebrew-related, related to Messianic prophecy, Jewish background to the New Testament, related to Israel today, related to Jewish people, Jewish tradition more broadly, those are the calls that we take on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. So 866-348-7884. So what about the parallels with President Trump? All right, let's have my guys, Kai and Matt, do a little fact-checking for me. Is it true that Benjamin Netanyahu has been married three times, just as President Trump has? Is that true? Let's try this. Is it true that there is adultery in Netanyahu's past for which he publicly confessed and asked forgiveness? Is that true? Is it true that there are corruption charges hanging over his head? We just talked about that. Is it true that as of the latest poll, 71% of Israelis said it wouldn't affect their view of the prime minister, even if he was indicted? Is it true that he is known as a man of strong nationalism and putting Israel's security needs first and standing up for the people of Israel? Yeah, to everything I just said. So just like President Trump, you have a thrice married leader. I'm not condemning either in saying that. I'm just reporting facts. In both cases, there is known adultery in the past. In the case of Netanyahu, while he was a political leader, so it hurt him more in that regard. It was, as far as Donald Trump, we knew this is his past. He's been an immoral guy. Then it's interesting, you've got these charges hanging over each of their heads, or potential charges, or what's going to happen? Was there campaign finance violations with President Trump? Was there fraud and bribery with Prime Minister Netanyahu? But then remarkably, those who support Netanyahu are saying, doesn't matter if true, we'd still stand with him because these are the more important issues. He's the right man to lead the nation. And the supporters of President Trump, by and large, say, who cares about these charges, whether they're true or not, who knows? But the big thing is, he's the man to protect our nation and to stand for security and things like that. It's just very interesting. Similar types of leaders, strong alpha male type leaders, strong nationalist leaders, and I don't say that as a dirty word, by the way, strong security leaders and leaders with checkered pasts. By the way, just as an aside, Benjamin Netanyahu is the son of a world-class historian, Ben-Sion Netanyahu, I believe that's the first name, most famous for his, 1,500-page study of the Inquisition and a lot of the Jewish aspects of it, purging Jewishness or Jewish roots or Jewish practices from the Catholic Church after the forced conversion of Jews in the times of the Crusades and thereafter. So he's the son of a famous historian, and perhaps that gives him a little bit more of an interest in history. So when he's written some things, he's written with a literacy that you would not necessarily expect from a political leader, but could be in the family heritage and blood. So I don't know what's best for Israel from here. In many ways, I like Netanyahu. Many ways I like his strength when he speaks before Congress. The support he gets is tremendous. He is inspirational in that regard. And I do believe that he's concerned with the well-being of Christian citizens in Israel as well, and Muslim citizens. I believe he does care, but he's definitely putting the security of the Jewish state first and foremost, as you would expect the prime minister to do. So what's going to happen going forward? Don't know. We'll see. But it's going to be a volatile time leading up to April 9th. And the fact is, as long as Hamas bombs Israel, as long as terrorists attack Israel, as long as these things happen, a strong leader like Netanyahu is going to be very popular. And the more left-wing parties are not going to be as popular. All right. We'll go to the phones when we come back. The bottom of the hour, I'm going to speak with a friend from Israel about what's happening in Syria and the potential crisis for the Kurds, the Christians there. So Kurds and Christians there. So we'll be getting into that. But we'll come back, talk to you, take your calls, 866-348-7884. And you know what? It's 5 weeks, not even 5 weeks off. You could still, if you can sign up today, get all your payment in today, you can still go with us to Israel February 1st through February 10th. You got to do it now. We did open the extra seats a few weeks ago, but got to do it now. If you're coming, that's at our website, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Right back with your calls.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. 866-348-7884 is the number to call. By the way, my latest article asks the question, what am I missing when it comes to immigration? You know I don't speak about that a lot on the air. I don't write about it. Number one, I have no expertise in the subject whatsoever. Number two, I've not been particularly burdened by the Lord to focus on it. You can only focus on so many things. You can't be a specialist in 1,000 different areas. And there are others that do focus on this, so we rely on their wisdom, and we've had them on as guests, and we've linked to their articles. But I just had a few questions to ask and say, hey, what am I missing here? I've got no partisan bias in writing. It's not pro-Trump, anti-Trump. I've just got some questions. So I went to one website where it was posted, and fascinatingly enough, I'm told that I have a thinly veiled right-wing political agenda in what I wrote. No, I had questions. It always amazes me when people know you better than you know yourself. They can tell you why you did a particular thing. They can tell you what motivates you to do a particular thing. They can tell you what you're really thinking. Always fascinates me. That's not related to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, but I thought I would just mention that, throw that out. All right, 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to James on Long Island. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Good afternoon, Dr. Brenner.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for taking my call. Okay, I have two questions. I don't know if I'll be able to ask both of them. The first question that I have, the Bible said can you hear me?
Yeah, are you speaking directly into your phone? I hope you don't have me on speaker because it's a little hard to hear you.
What about now?
A little better. Keep going.
Okay. The first question that I have is like, did God allow David to marry Saul's wives, or does the word "I give you Saul's wife" more to care for them, or is it that they become his wife? The problem that I'm having with that, I think in the book of Leviticus, it says you cannot marry a daughter and the mother. So David's first wife was Michal, which would be one of Saul's wife's daughter. So if after Saul died, God gave David permission to marry all his wives, doesn't that violate that verse in Leviticus, I believe, 18 or 19?
Yeah, so you also have the issue of, for example, Jacob marrying two sisters, which was forbidden by Leviticus 18. But, of course, he didn't do that willingly. And that was also, in other words, he didn't choose to marry Rachel. He didn't choose to marry Leah. That just happened. But that was also before that law was given. But certainly it was a wrong thing. It was a bad thing. And the marriages were fraught with difficulties because of it. So there are many things that happen in the Bible that are contrary to God's will and to God's ways. And yet they happen and they're recorded. But your point, though, is an important one, because in this case, it would be God saying, yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm going to give them to you. By the way, what specific verse are you pointing to in terms of?
I believe that's 2 Samuel 8.
Right.
I don't know. I'm nervous. I kind of forgot the exact verse.
But no, don't worry about it. It's just the two of us talking. No reason to be nervous at all. All right. Because the word of judgment is given here. And it doesn't ring a bell in 2 Samuel, the eighth chapter. But you could be right. No, it's not for sure. But in any case, the question would be, would God give David, if he was married to a daughter, also that mother in marriage? And the answer is obviously not. God would not do that in terms of blessing David or something in his will or something in his plan. And if we look at Michal here, so Saul's sons, I'm reading from 1 Samuel 14, were Jonathan, Ishvi, Malchishua. The names of his two daughters were Merab, his firstborn, and Michal, the younger, right? So yeah. Michal, daughter of Saul, therefore Saul's mother was a wife of, Michal's mother was a wife of Saul. So as I understand it, it was not that God was giving them the wives so that he would take them all in sexually and have relationships as much as part of the judgment on Saul and David inheriting everything would have them as well. If David then went to act on that in a sexual way, that would be in violation of Leviticus 18, which of course already had been given as part of the law. So your question is well taken. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree, because when I look in the Hebrew, I forgot what the word is. For some reason, I cannot think right now. It seems like, because it says, I give them to you in your bosom. And then when you go to Isaiah 40, verse 11, it's more like to care for them. So I look
yeah,
at
like
it,
in Isaiah 40, where God says, so carry the sheep in his bosom as a shepherd. It could mean either. It could have a sexual connotation. It doesn't have to have a sexual connotation. We'd have to judge it more by the context. All right, let's keep going. You got another question? Let's go for it.
Yes, the other question that I have. Now, I have researched the Bible very thoroughly, and that is one of the reasons is because of you. Because if you got a million videos on YouTube, I think I have watched 999,000 of
them. Awesome, man. Thank you.
I have watched all your debates. Now, the question that I have is like, the December 25th, it's not in the Bible. Now, when I read Luke 2 or Luke 1, when he says there was a prophet by the name of Zechariah who was performing his course of Abiah. Now, I look back in Chronicles, it says that David broke down the prophet into 24 different works, I guess, schedule.
Yep.
Abiah would be Abijah, the house of Abijah, or Abijah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it says when the angel came to Mary that Elizabeth was already 6 months pregnant. Now, if you take the course of Abijah, that would be the 21st of May. And then I think the whichever Jewish holiday come after the 21st of May, all the prophet will recommend, all the priests were recommended to be in the temple. So it looked like Zachariah got Elizabeth pregnant in early June. So from June to December, that would be 6 months. So when he says Elizabeth was already 6 months, from December to September, that would be 40 weeks. That's the amount you could carry a pregnancy. So it would seem, well, I really believe that Jesus was born in September. Now, what better day than September 11, which is like the day?
Yeah, hang on. Just one thing. I appreciate you digging into that, and I want to comment on it in a minute. But just to understand this, if she's 6 months pregnant in December, right? Okay, so then 3 more months, that gets you either to late February, early March, right?
That would be John the Baptist, because it was Elizabeth that was already 6 months pregnant.
Got it. Okay.
When the angel came to Mary.
Right. You just left. Right. So, you left that part of the math out. So
there are.
So just to fill in that blank there. So, sir, there are others who've looked at this the exact same way, who've said, okay, Luke 1, you've got this priestly ministry going on, and when would he have served and gone to the records and Chronicles? And there are others who've argued for a birth date of September, October, and said that what a perfect time for the Word to become flesh. John 1:14, he pitched his tent among us. What if it was during Sukkot, tabernacles? So there are Messianic Jews that I know, when they celebrate Sukkot, when they celebrate tabernacles, they also celebrate this as the time when they believe the Word became flesh. Now, we can't prove it. It's difficult to prove. And in fact, sir, there are early church leaders who believed that the date was December 25th. You say, well, how would that work out with the data that you have there? It's a fair question. And others would say, well, how is it going to be in Luke, the second chapter, that shepherds are out at night with their flocks, that the time of the year would be too cold to be out, and therefore they wouldn't be out at night with the flocks. And so it's unlikely. But just to say that there are early church traditions that believe that was the birth date, December 25th. I don't know. I've never looked at it as this is the birth date and therefore celebrate the birth of Jesus at this time. But can you make an argument that it couldn't be at that time and that it must be a few months earlier based on these calculations and arguments? The answer is yes. And others have made the same argument. The fact is, God didn't give us a specific date, nor were we commanded in the Word to have a specific holiday celebrating the birth of Yeshua. Nonetheless, to whatever extent people can glorify God for the incarnation, glorify God for sending his Son into the world, and celebrate that in a way that brings him glory and is not worldly or carnal or pagan, wonderful. Have at it. But thanks, James, for doing the digging and explaining it in that way. Again, some might dispute a detail here and there, but the overall argument others have done as well, and I appreciate you digging and coming up with that. So, can you make a case for the Messiah coming into the world during the Feast of Tabernacles, about that time? And could that be the imagery of John 1:14, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, which is literally pitched his tent among us? Worth considering. Hey, thanks for following us so carefully and keep challenging us all to keep digging into the Word. If you differ with our brother, just do your homework and see where he got his data from. All right, 866-34-TRUTH. We come back. I'm going to speak with a colleague from Israel, Michael Niebuhr. And Michael and I were together earlier in the year in Israel. Was it earlier this year? I think so. I think it was earlier this year, if not this last, but I think it was earlier this year. We had some good fellowship together, a good time before the Lord, and he has a great heart for Jew and Gentile in Messiah, working together as one in the Middle East. So the news, President Trump, that our 2,000 troops in Syria were going to be pulled out has really sent shockwaves through the region. Is it fixed? Is there a possibility that he'll change his mind? Many are praying for that. But we'll get a perspective from Israel when we come back. Stay right here.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Thanks so much for joining us today. This is Michael Brown. The number to call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Let's focus right now on the situation in Israel. Israel is flanked by hostile neighbors. If you want to jump a decent distance over to Iran, Iran continues to speak of the destruction of Israel and wanting to wipe out Israel and telling Israel, you dare go after our nuclear development or anything like that, and we will wipe you off the map and speak frequently in the ugliest terms about Israel and chant death to Israel in the streets. Egypt to the south is in a better relationship with Israel, but there's still a lot of anti-Semitism in Egypt. There's been a peace treaty, but there's still a lot of anti-Semitism there. When you go to the southwest, you have Gaza Strip ruled by Hamas. And Hamas is dead set to see Israel wiped out. Now, of course, its power and resources are greatly limited by the embargo and by various restraints that are put on Hamas. Nonetheless, there is an ongoing attempt by Hamas to undermine Israeli security, and they'd be kidnapping and killing every single day if they could. As you then go up to the north, you have Lebanon and Syria. And there is terrorism that comes to Israel through Lebanon. Hezbollah, for example, being strongly ensconced there. And of course, Hezbollah being supported by Iran. And then you have Syria, which remains in a state of war with Israel, and the nation itself in tremendous chaos because of the ongoing war, really civil war there. Then you have the different factions involved. You have the Saudis, who are supporting the Sunni Muslims. You have the Iranians, who are supporting the Shiite Muslims. You have the Christian minority that gets stuck in the middle. You have the Kurdish minority that gets stuck in the middle. Even though the Kurds are primarily Muslims, they're still a minority ethnically. They get stuck in the middle. And then you have Turkey, which in years past was less hostile to Israel, but with a more right-wing Islamic government under the current prime minister, there is more hostility towards Israel. And although Turkey has said, hey, we are absolutely going to annihilate any bit of ISIS that remains, there are real concerns that Turkey will do no such thing, and that Turkey instead will attack the Kurds. In fact, I saw a headline earlier today warning about that very thing, that Turkey is going to try to wipe out the Kurds in Syria. So our presence, only 2,000 people, only 2,000 troops, but we have had a great impact in the region. Of course, Russia under Putin has a real interest in Syria there. So It is a battlefield for the Middle East. It is a battlefield for the entire region. So stakes are very high. Many, many, many lives lost. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands either killed or seriously injured. Millions displaced. Lebanon just basically taking in refugees to the limit. Other countries, Iraq, flooded with refugees. In fact, we have a strong team of grads from our ministry school, from Fire School of Ministry, who are serving in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan. And shortly after their arrival there, refugees began flooding in almost in their backyard. So suddenly there were tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in real need, people hurting, both genuine Christian, nominal Muslim, religious Muslim. So they've been having a wonderful time reaching out with the gospel, with the good news. So on the one hand, President Trump did say, I want to bring our troops home. I want to do my best to bring our troops home. And he said, hey, I'm doing it. Why isn't everybody excited? But others saying, no, this is the wrong time and place. We've made a commitment to the people there. And there's some very strong articles that have been written criticizing President Trump, urging him not to do this, saying, listen, you just blinked. You let Erdogan, the prime minister of Turkey, you let him win the day, and you're listening to his lies, and this is going to be a disaster for the Christians and for the Kurds. The Kurds are fighting with all their might. Here's an article saying Turkey committed ethnic cleansing in northern Cyprus. They will do so again in Kurdistan. So there are concerns here. Kurdistan and then obviously Iraq, Syria, closely related here. Kurdistan, of course, in northern Iraq. So a lot of concern for what's happening. I know for a fact that some very strong articles urging the president to reconsider have been given to his staff on the high level and hopefully have gotten into the hands of the president as well. And this is something we can certainly pray for God to have his way. And if in fact it is going to be bloodshed for many innocent people and American troops can help now, then by all means, may God turn the president's heart. There's more to the story, though. According to what I've read, and I have no inside information on this, just what I just told you was inside information in terms of articles, strong articles, urging the president to change his mind and saying he made a terrible mistake. I know for a fact that those have been given to major players and his staff with the goal of getting it directly into his hands. That I know. What I'm about to say, I just know based on reading the same stuff you read, based on seeing the same stuff you see. So, in a nutshell, I read that Prime Minister Netanyahu did his best to dissuade President Trump from this decision and was not able to dissuade him, and that Israel as a whole is not happy with this because basically it just gives Syria and Iran based in Syria much more free rein to attack again through Hezbollah and others. And from what I've read, Israel has already begun to up its bombing of Hezbollah targets in anticipation of potential attack. But there is a lot going on, and I want to speak with Michael Karam from Israel and discuss these issues. So, Michael, hang on. There we go. Glad to have you on the line of fire today. Thanks so much for calling in.
Yeah, it's good to be with you. I always enjoy listening to your podcast, even over here in Israel.
Well, thanks, sir. So what, it's about 10:40 in the evening there, or is it 9:40?
It's 10:40 in the evening.
10:40. Okay, got it. All right, first, before we talk about Syria, talk about Road to Abraham and the work that you're involved with in Israel.
Well, we're a network of disciples that work on all over the Middle East. We participate together in different projects. Some of them are relief related. Some of them are discipleship. Some of them are prayer initiatives. And basically, it's kind of a framework around the Isaiah 19 highway. So this scripture, this very specific scripture that actually finds an expression in many places through the Bible, but is sort of clearly outlined in this vision that Isaiah had of a highway that would not only bless Israel, but would bless the entire earth. And so we're not so concerned about this road, this Derek Abraham, which is kind of the same path that Abraham followed from Assyria down to Egypt and then ended up in Israel. We're, as a prophecy to be fulfilled, as much as we are using it as a framework for doing ministry in the Middle East. So we're trying to bring together people from many nations and backgrounds and ethnic groups to give a different expression, a kingdom expression, to people in the Middle East.
Got it. And you yourself, you've got an interesting family background. Tell me about your wife, kids, adopted kids.
So I actually started off after university going to serve in the Middle East and ended up in Turkey, where I met my wife, a Turkish Armenian. Actually, her father was a survivor of the Armenian genocide. Mm. And I wasn't even thinking at that point about marrying somebody from the Middle East. But as it was, I was praying for her for a husband, and the Lord spoke and said, this is going to be your wife. You're going to be her husband. I was a bit shocked by this because I couldn't really speak to her, and there were also a lot of other sort of barriers to this relationship. But anyway, to make a long story short, my claim to fame was I proposed through a translator, and we were married 33 years ago. We have four children. And then we adopted fostered two Sudanese refugee children here in Israel. But we came to Israel in 1992 to use it as a base to go in the Muslim world. We didn't really know about this highway and how it was going to affect our work. But the more we sort of read the scripture and looked at the call that God had placed on our lives to the Turkish and Kurdish Muslim world from Israel, we started to see that not only we had this vision, but people were coming from all over the world, many nations, with this vision of a highway. Said, I read this scripture in Isaiah 19. I want to do this. How do I do it? And we were the same place they were. We said, we're not really sure, but it sure is compelling. It's interesting. And it again started us on a journey that continues to this day.
And you would obviously have intimate knowledge about Turkey being much more secular nation in recent years, then shifting more to the right under the current prime minister. We do want to focus on Syria, and we'll get there in a moment. But if you can just give an overview in maybe a minute and a half or so, what's happening with Syria, with Turkey today?
Well, about kind of in the mid to late 80s, there was a very strong, sort of late 70s, early 80s, there was a very strong communist movement in Turkey. And that was not only, that affected many sort of ethnic parts and very many portions of society. But to make it very, very short, basically the Kurds sort of developed their own nationalistic movement in the south and the east of the country. And that became in a sense a reaction against Turkish nationalism, which had gone from from 1920, the whole state, where it denied basically the Kurds even any kind of cultural, any kind of ethnic, any kind of expression of who they were as a people. So this was a reaction after about, we'll say 50 years. And basically for the last 20 or 30 years, the Kurds in the eastern part of the country have sort of started their own path to, maybe forming their own nation, but at least having some kind of cultural, linguistic expression there. So this has been an ongoing problem, even in the secular sort of nation. Now, the last 15 years, since the current administration, the Justice and Development Party took over, their idea was to sort of bring, as each many governments try, bring us some.
Tell you what, I'm just going to cut you off right here in mid-sentence. We'll pick this up on the other side of the break, and I want you to hear Michael's heart. He's really burdened about the Kurds and about President Trump's decision. I think it's important you hear this. Stay right here.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
When you hear that Hebrew singing, you know it's thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm not going to give the phone number out now because I want to devote the rest of our time to my guest, Michael Karam from Israel. So, Michael, you were talking about the Kurds in Turkey and some of the development there. Just a quick question to clarify this for our listeners and viewers. What makes the Kurds the Kurds? Who are the Kurds? You have them in northern Iraq. You have them in Turkey. Is it an ethnic group? Is it a religious group? How do we define the Kurds?
So the Kurds are about anywhere, it's hard to kind of measure, but anywhere from about 35 to 40 million people. They're probably the largest ethnic group in the world today without their own nation state. They trace their roots back to the ancient Medes, who were an interesting group that we find in the biblical narrative, and very much a part of the time that the Jewish people spend in exile in the Medo-Persian Empire. But today they kind of populate mainly four different countries, and they're found in four different countries of the Middle East, very strategic places in southeastern Turkey, northwestern Iran, northern Iraq, and then in Syria, eastern Syria.
All right, so why should we in America, and I'm asking these questions because many Americans don't understand this, why should we in America be risking the lives of our soldiers in Syria for the sake of the Kurds? I mean, there are a lot of people around the world. We can't be everywhere and help everyone. We'd love to do that, but America's not the world's policeman. So why do we have any relationship with them? Why do we care? Why is it important that our troops are helping the Kurds? Shed some light on this for us.
So during the whole sort of this period of the Syrian civil war or the Syrian regional war and the emergence of ISIS, the Kurds in eastern Syria and the Democratic Syrian sort of army and everything has been mainly populated or mainly made up of Kurds, not only from Syria, but from Iraq and even Iran. Not only men, but women as well. They've been some of the most loyal sort of fighters with the coalition forces and with the United States in eastern Syria. And they stood side by side and really put their lives on the line to sort of stop ISIS, sort of progress in Syria. And in a way, if it's not stopped there, it'll keep going. And if it keeps going, it'll come to Israel. And if it comes to Israel, it'll go to the West. It won't stop. So in a way, the war isn't just about Syria itself or just about the Kurds. It affects every nation. It affects nations in Europe. It affects the West as well. And so in a way, they're standing on the front lines of a battle that, in a sense, is for many of the freedoms that we hold dear, not only here in Israel, but in the West as well. But they also see, this is an interesting point, but the Kurds see Israel as a model for them in the Middle East. Why? Because in a sense, we built a state here in the Middle East. We built a state as a democratic state where people can, be free to express their faith to the most extent and be able to have the freedoms that most Western societies. And the Kurds see Israel as a model. You built a state, we want a state like that. They see us as really a model for them. So it's not only about America's relationship with the Kurds, it's about America's relationship with Israel. It's also about stemming the tide of, Iran's desire to build a bridge from Tehran all the way to Beirut, basically from Iran to the Mediterranean Sea. So the Kurds stand right in the middle of that bridge. So they're an important ally, not only for the United States in the fight against Islamic State, but they're also an important ally for Israel. But they also stand, in a sense, in a very strategic part because they are sort of... Their geographical territory where they are also has some of the most richest land of mineral resources in the Middle East.
And why is it so dramatic? 2,000 troops, it's not that many people. Why would it have such an impact if we pull our troops out?
Right. The significance not only isn't so much the 2,000, it's what those 2,000 represent. Most of those 2,000 are not volunteers or whatever. They're not, they're not just infantrymen. Those are people that are specialists. They're experts. They're giving support. They're training. They put together a 30 to 40,000 fighting force. Now, Islamic State is not finished by any means. They still have a huge sort of concentration right in the middle of Syria, and they're just biding their time. They've got great resources there as well. This war is not over at all. So they are a strategic ally for us in that area. And plus that 2,000 really represents our commitment, in a sense, to keeping things kind of where they are around there. Because the Kurds, like we said, they're going to be under attack by many different nations because they inhabit many of the lands that have really rich resources, and other countries want possession of those resources. So for various reasons, it's important that we stand. Now, here's another thing that's really important. The Syrian Kurds especially are some of the most open to the gospel right now of any of the people around. Many of today are in Europe, some are in northern Iraq as refugees, others in Turkey and refugees, some are in Greece as refugees. They're spread out all over the Middle East, but they are the most open right now to the gospel. And in a way, they want to build they want to build their own nation right there in eastern Syria. They've already set up a government and everything like that. Now, they're also Christians. They're Assyrian Christians there as well. And they understand that if Turkey comes in, their freedoms and their sort of life as they know it could end as well. So there's already refugees starting to flood out of eastern Syria into northern Iraq. Up to 1 million people could be directly affected by a Turkish invasion. And this already happened in northwest Syria. So what's happened and gone on is very well known. And right now we're in the middle of winter. In the middle of winter, it's not easy for people to move. And if refugees start going, a lot of them are probably going to die on the way. There's already a huge refugee problem around the Middle East. We don't need another one. So it's, in a way, it's crucial that we pray for this decision to be reversed, not only for the sake of these people, but as well for the sake of what God's doing among them, not only in eastern Syria and Iraq, but as well in many other nations.
So we're praying for the president to change his mind on this. Again, we've been there. We are involved. And even if some folks are saying, okay, this does raise humanitarian issues, and you raise many points about Iran and Turkey, et cetera, but most evangelicals in America are concerned about Israel, and they do believe that America should stand with Israel. So the people of Israel themselves and Prime Minister Netanyahu himself, they're not happy with President Trump's decision. What are they concerned with what might happen with American troops pulled out of there? Who's going to fill the vacuum as they see it?
Exactly. That's the big question. Who's going to fill the vacuum? Right now, Turkey is getting closer to Russia. It's getting closer to Iran. And for us to encourage them in that way doesn't seem like a very good strategic decision as we can see it here in Israel. Why? Because we talked about this highway that they're wanting to build, another highway, a highway that's not in the Bible, a highway from Tehran all the way to Beirut. This would put as well many other people, especially Israel, in jeopardy in that way. So Israel is less concerned about that because we live here, we're going to take care of ourselves, we're not going to entrust our security to anybody else. But it doesn't make our job any easier because it emboldens people that are already have territorial designs or that have expressed very, very clear interest or very clear sort of goals against Israel as a nation state. And clearly speaking, Turkey has turned in many ways very Islamist, and they're very much focused on, you know, on what is happening here in Israel in not a very positive way. And so in a way, this emboldens other people in the area that, you know, are not for Israel, are against Israel, not out for Israel's best. And so in a way, we see America's support key in this thing, and then pulling out would definitely be not a good thing for us. And we're concerned about who would fill that vacuum. So this is a real issue of prayer right now, not only for Israel, not only for the Kurds in Syria, not only for, you know, just the situation in northern Iraq with all these refugees as well. It could create another humanitarian disaster, as well as being a strategic decision that could have ramifications for us here in Israel.
My friends, that's a lot of information, but I would dare say that about 99% of that is stuff that was new to many, because we're not hearing it in those details. We're not hearing it in the humanitarian way. We're more hearing it in a debate for or against President Trump. And Michael, we've got a good-sized team, as you know, that's based in northern Iraq, grads from our ministry school serving there. They love the Kurdish people. They work among them. They're seeing fruit. They're seeing Muslims coming to faith, nominal Christians coming to faith. They have a house of prayer going on there, discipling, teaching. And of course, the question of, you know, there's always the push for Kurdish independence, and that would have massive ramifications in the region as well. But you can't say a whole lot about what's happening in the Muslim world without betraying confidence here or there. So you have to speak in general terms. But are you, as someone eyewitness in the middle of this on the inside, we've just got 1 minute, are you seeing a real increase in terms of genuine Muslim conversions, Muslims coming to Jesus in the Middle East?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in a way, God will use any situation. Some of them are not the best ones, but he causes all things to work, in a sense, for good for those, you know, who are called them. And I believe the Kurds are called at this area. This is at this time in history. And so, you know, in a way, we've seen horrible tragedies, but at the same time, Muslims are more open today than they've ever been.